He just seemed like I'd known him forever when I first started talking with him. And he's been very active in service work and been influential in helping us to become more active in, or I speak for me becoming more active in service work. In fact, he came to Lake Charles not very long ago and spoke at our workshop we had. Our workshop was wonderful. So we had other people there too. But since I'm introducing him, I guess I better stick with Jay. He's our delegate, as you all know, from Louisiana to go to World Service. He's very active in all service work and very active in meetings. He also can bring into his personal life our three legacies, you know, the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. And I think that's wonderful because I see he's living this program in his actions. And in one of the notes I wrote to him, I thanked his wife for sharing him with us because he's been so helpful to all of us. At this time, I'd like to introduce Jay.
Hi, I'm JP. I'm a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Thank you for inviting me to be your speaker tonight. And our theme says, change begins within. And, you know, everything changes. And my life has changed. And changes is constant, but it brings a lot of good things in me. And hope today I can share some of my experiences and see what changes has done to my life. And one of the biggest change occurred when I was back in high school. And our teacher assigned the class to gather the information about different countries and present it to the class. And my group was assigned with United States of America. And all the information that I gathered, I was just absolutely fascinated about this country. The technological advancements, you know, automobiles and rockets and high-rising buildings, and you don't see all those things in India, so I was really, really impressed. And I just, you know, started discussing that, hey, you know, I would like to go to the United States someday to study and find out and, you know, get to know this country. And my teachers supported me, and my parents were the biggest supporter, and they said that, you know, my dad said that he will take care of all the expenses and just follow my dreams. And by the time I graduated from high school, my mind was made up that I will definitely go to the United States to study some sort of an engineering. And my dad wanted me to come here after high school, and I wasn't ready. I didn't speak good English, and I wanted to make sure that I have some career or something, a degree, so if I fail in this adventure, at least I have something that I can fall back on. So I went to St. Xavier's High School, and all the professors were Jesuit priests. So that's where, you know, I learned a lot about English, speaking English, writing. All the books were in English. And I did a B.S. degree in chemistry and physics. And after that, I was ready to come to the United States. So on January 27th, 1967, I came to the United States to go to Louisiana State University to study chemical engineering. And I was 22 years old. Can I get some water, please? I was 22 years old and full of energy, full of dreams, and it was one of the biggest excitement that I had ever been on any kind of trips. And I spent my first night at the Pleasant Hall on LSU campus. And it was a long journey, so I was tired, and I fell asleep, and I was dreaming, and I was with my family, I was having a great time, and in the middle of my dream, I woke up, and the room that I was in didn't look anything like my home. And for a minute, I didn't know exactly where I was. I jumped out of my bed, and I was literally shaking. And this is the first time I realized that I'm all alone, far away from home, you know, oceans and land, you know, many lands away, and it will be a long time before I will see my family. I was also a vegetarian, so I had a difficult time getting adjusted to the non-vegetarian food. I didn't think about that either. And by the end of the semester, I had lost 30 pounds and I weighed about 120 pounds. And about a mid-semester, I got a note from the Dean of Engineering, Dr. Ferguson. He wanted to see me for my grades. And most of my grades were F's and D's. And, you know, I didn't sleep all night, you know. I said, how am I going to explain to Dr. Ferguson my sorry state of existence? And but he welcomed me with a firm shake hand and a smile on his face. And he said that what I'm going through is not unusual. And many foreign students go through an adjustment period, and especially someone like me coming from as far away as from India. And he also recommended that I should drop all the courses that I'm failing, and rather than going to the summer school, just go to do a summer job, get adjusted, and come back to study hard. And I tell you, he gave me a lot of hope, and I understood that I just need to take it easy. I'm going through the adjustment period, and after a while, I'll settle down. I'll be okay. And I couldn't wait till the end of the semester, and I got on the New Orleans to San Francisco Greyhound Express. And boy, it was great. You know, finally, I'm getting a chance to see the country that I have admired so long. And in those days, they were like a double-decker Greyhound buses. And I slowly made my way up to the front row seat, so I had a, you know, huge glass window in front of me, and for 2.5 day journey, I hardly slept. I just, you know, even the bus pulled in at the station in the middle of the night, I got up and, you know, I walked around to see. So eventually I made it to Lake Tahoe, and I found a job as a kitchen helper in one of the big casinos up there. And I soon found out that just a bowl of cereal in the morning and fruits is just not going to carry me through 8 hours of work. But the as a kitchen helper, I was also entitled to 3 free meals a day. So, you know, I thought that, you know, this is an ideal opportunity for me to get used to it. So one day I got brave and I went to Chef Jack, and I asked me to fix me a hamburger without the meat patty. And he turned around and he looked at me and he started just jumping and laughing, and it just created a big commotion. So all the kitchen staff came over and they heard and they all had a big laugh. But he fixed me a hamburger and I enjoyed it. It was great. And one day I was sitting in the lunchroom drinking Coke, and he came, you know, Jack came and sat next to me, and he said, how come I'm not eating? And I said, you know, I can't eat this all. Everything has meat, and I'm a vegetarian, and I need to get adjusted. Otherwise, you know, before end of the summer, because if I don't, I really do not know what will happen to me. So he says, don't worry, you know, why didn't you tell me earlier? I can take care of it. So he started making me tuna salad and chicken salad sandwiches. And, you know, they didn't look like meat, they didn't taste like meat, and they were delicious. And, you know, so I was just happy trying his sandwiches. And there were 3 other restaurants in the casino, and those chefs found out, and, you know, so they started bringing me small servings of steaks and lobsters and shrimp, and wow, it was great. And, you know, every day everybody will ask me how am I doing, and, you know, they were just happy to see me happy, and I just couldn't believe that so many strangers would come to my rescue. You know, I thought it was, I'm alone, this is my problem, and I was just, you know, I was not talking about it, but it really surprised me that so many people care for me. And today I do not know if they hadn't taken time to, you know, nurture me, I don't know where I would have been. I probably would have gone back home. Well, anyway, so I came back well-adjusted to go to study, and I started making good grades, and I was doing great. My social life at LSU was very limited. I spent a lot of time on studies. Of course, that's why, you know, I came here for. And but I had quite a few Persian classmates, and they lived a few doors down from my apartment, and they used to have parties all the time. Loud music, open door, so, you know, by midnight, you know, their apartment will get packed with all the partygoers. So once in a while I go in and check out to see, you know, what's all this commotion about. And it was great, you know. And summer of 69, at one of those parties, I met my first wife, Judy. And, man, she was a movie star. She had a great personality. You know, everybody knew her. She was just joking and laughing. And we went out a few times and we started dating. And it was just a joy to be around. You know, I'm kind of shy, quiet, studious guy. And she was just constantly, she was just talking jokes and funny. And I just enjoyed that. She was just a wonderful company. But after a while, I realized that this is going to may interfere with my studies. So I gracefully back out, and I told her that, you know, I'm getting big assignments, and it's taking a lot of time, so I got to go back to study. That's why I have come here for. And a few months later, she called me back, and she said that she's studying nursing, and she's taking chemistry and physics classes, and she's having a little difficulty, and if I would... excuse me, if I would help her. And I told her that I study at the LSU library, and you know, she can come over there and meet me, and I'll work with her. And she came a few times, and before we know it, we were going study at LSU library. We became study partners. And one day she came over to my apartment, and she saw a large collection of rock and roll records. And she found out that I like music, but I never go dancing. So she says that, hey, you know, there is a club across the river in Port Island called He and She Club. And you know, they play this kind of music, and you will really enjoy it. Man, she was right. I walked in the club, and it had a glass dance floor, and, you know, all kinds of reds and greens and blue lights were just flashing, And they even had a psychedelic projections on the wall and on the ceiling, and they were, you know, synchronized with the music. So at the beat of the music, they all flash, and it was great. And she liked those 4 ounce cans of Schlitz malt liquor that came in a blue silver can. She loved it. I mean, you know, I just had never seen her so happy, you know, with holding the can. I made sure that I had enough money to buy all the small, sweet, small liquor she can drink. A wonderful partnership was in works. We were studying good, we were partying good, and we were inseparable. And one day she invited me over to her house for dinner and to meet her family. And I said, yeah, you know, it'd be great. Yeah, I have never been to any American family, but I'm not quite aware of the social significance of this event, but, you know, I went. And her dad thanked me over and over for studying and helping her studies because, you know, her grade had come up quite a bit since we started studying together. Her mother was, you know, great. She was just a lovely personality, made me feel home, welcomed me. Her two sisters and her husbands and children came over, aunt and uncle lived next door, they came over. And it was just wonderful to be a family. It was a great family and kind of made me homesick for a little while. I missed my family, but it was a great family. And nothing is happening in the kitchen, you know. So I asked her, I said, are you sure you invited me for dinner? I said, yeah, Daddy's going to boil some crawfish. And she told her dad to show me. So he took me to the backyard, and you know, there is a tin, oval-shaped tin can, you know, full of water. And he says a crawfish in there, and I'm looking at it. You know, sun is shining, and I'm looking for fish in it. You know, and I said I don't see anything. So he picked up a can of salt and sprinkled it, and man, the water started boiling. All these black creatures were just. Just gross me out. So I went inside and I pulled her on the side and I, you know, spoke in her ear. I said, there is no way I'm going to eat this. And And she said, hush up and act like you know what you're doing. You know, I had to make a good impression. You know, I can tell the dad that, you know, hey, I'm not going to eat this. Well, anyway, so, you know, I sat through the whole process of boiling, and this is a new concept for me that something, you know, a massive quantity of this live creatures will be killed in front of me, and I'll have to eat it. Yeah. And I just ate corn and potatoes. So her dad thought that, you know, I didn't know how to peel the crawfish, so he, you know, showed me how to peel, and I still won't eat anything. So he peeled a few for me, you know, and so I had to eat, so I just dipped them in a sauce, and, you know, I just swallowed them whole. Playing on and all, you know, it turned out to be a wonderful evening, and her mother, you know, invited me to dinner over to their house. She says that she cooks dinner, supper every Sunday, and the whole family gets together and asks me, you know, to come by anytime I want to. And I did go there quite a few times. Excellent cook, and just wonderful, just absolutely wonderful people. I graduated in August 70, and I visited my family, and it was great. Thoroughly enjoyed it, and of course I brought up the subject of Judy, that, you know, I'm going to get married, and boy, they didn't like that idea at all. And but, you know, I talked and I explained, and I think what it boiled down to that they were disappointed that they knew that I will not be coming back home, and I will not be a part of their life, and that was the biggest concern that they had. Yeah, I came back, and Judy graduated from nursing a year later, and then we got married, and it was wonderful. We both were working, we were making lots of money, and we had never seen this kind of money before. I mean, you know, we bought a house, within 2 years we bought a house, we had two automobiles. She filled up the whole house with all kinds of furniture that she wanted. We had quite a few friends, and we were having, you know, lots of parties. We were taking big vacations. At work, things were going great for me. The five engineers came together by miraculous reason. We were all very talented. We worked hard. We became brother. We still hang out together. We were very successful, and we were handsomely rewarded for our talents. And any challenge they threw at us, we stood up to it, and we performed, and we completed all our projects ahead of the time, and less than the projected cost and all that stuff. 5 years into our marriage, our first son was born, and he brought another level of excitement, and it was just beautiful to just come home to see, you know, both of them happy and smiling, and at that point, we decided that my salary had doubled, more than doubled by that time, so we decided that she will stay home and take care of the baby. And we moved into a bigger house because we had planned to have more children, so that's something that we had planned. And things began to change after that. She decided that she's not going to have any more children. And I just couldn't imagine just raising, you know, one son by himself, and I did everything that I could do, but I soon learned that that was not negotiable, and she was firm, and so, you know, I said, well, let it go, and just try to be happy with what we have, and just be content, and I just let it go. Well, things kept getting worse from that point on, and her drinking is getting worse and worse at this point. And she started complaining about the job, that, you know, phone rings all the time. Now, that is nothing new, the kind of job I had. You know, I spent a lot of time at the plant. Sometimes I come late. Sometimes I have to go there in the evening. Sometimes I have to spend weekends there. But she said that she doesn't want all those phone calls at home, and it's affecting the peace of the home, and she doesn't want it. So I started looking for a job, and I found a job, and I turned in my resignation, and it was like a bombshell. Nobody understood, because we were so successful. We were like friends, and there was nothing at work that that would cause me to turn in the resignation. And they were all wondering, you know, why would I turn in the resignation, because it was just a total surprise to them. So I just lie and I say, you know, this new opportunity offers more promotional possibilities. So, you know, that's why I'm going. And so the new job was great. I came home at 4:30 and there were no phone calls. But things kept getting worse. And now, you know, she's attacking me that I'm not a good husband. I'm not a good father. I'm not pulling the load. And that's where my confusion began. You know, I'm beginning to think that, you know, what is going on here? And her drinking is getting bad at this time. And but somehow I convinced myself that, you know, this is how the lives are. You know, many couples fight and we're probably not any unique in any way. So I just learned to live with it. And it went on for quite a few years. And one day I realized that my son is getting affected by all those things. And that's where I woke up. And I went to see a... went to see it. I went to see a counselor, and I talked to her for over an hour, and at the end of the hour, I was totally exhausted, and I was crying uncontrollably. This is the first time I told anyone what is going on in my home. And she grabbed my two hands, looked into my eyes, and she said that from what I described, she believes that my wife may be suffering from the disease called alcoholism. I'm totally unaware of these things. I don't know anything about it. But I felt good that somebody in this world understands what is going on in my home. And it is a disease, so there has to be an answer. So I asked her, you know, when can I bring her to see the doctor? She was a nice lady, and with a straight face, she said that, you know, there are no doctors and there are no medicine for this disease. But there is a treatment program, and if my wife wishes to go through the treatment, then there is a good chance that, you know, she may get well. Now, you know, that is just not acceptable. You know, I say, you just tell me when to bring my wife, and I'll make sure she comes here, and she will go through the treatment program. Yeah, we get as sick as the alcoholics. She said that it doesn't work that way. And she said that I'll have to let all the close family members and all the friends know what is going on, and we will have to get everybody's support to talk to Judy and see if she can, you know, if we all can work and try to get her, convince her to come to treatment. And I said, absolutely not, I cannot do that because nobody knows about this. And if I tell them, you know, it will be a big shock to them. I said, we cannot do that. And she says, no, we'll have to do that. And another bombshell. We had hidden this thing so carefully that it came as a big surprise to everyone. They just had no idea that something like this was happening, and it has gone this far. And we went through the treatment program, but it just didn't work out for us at all. We fought like cats and dogs all through the early part of the treatment. And I guess we had waited so long that our relationship was badly battered, and neither one of us had any interest to really work on the relationship. So we were just arguing and making things worse. So finally, and we were going through the outpatient treatment, so finally our counselor pulled us together and told us that we both need to go to inpatient treatment and one-on-one counseling, and we both categorically refused. So finally we agreed that, okay, we will go through marriage counseling, and we did that, and again, it didn't work. Our mind was made up to just depart. So we finally separated. In 1984, we separated, and now my worst nightmare has come true. This is the lowest point of my life, and I truly believe that I'm finished. There is no hope for me. Nobody will ever want to be my friends. I will never be happy again. And the thoughts of going home came also, but my family, my friends, my teachers had such a high expectation of me that if I go home like this, you know, I would be a great disappointment to them. This kind of negative thoughts were running through my head like runaway freight train all the time that I couldn't stop. But once in a while I would hear what my counselor at CDU used to tell me that, hey Jay, you need to start going to 3 to 4 Al-Anon meetings a week. I had nothing to lose and I was willing to try anything, so I started attending 3 to 4 Al-Anon meetings a week. And I went there and I said, you know, I have much bigger problems, you know. I just don't see how this Al-Anon is going to help me. And they said, keep coming back. And I said, you know, my problems are much bigger, you know. This little piece of cloth hanging on the wall is just not going to help me. They said, just keep coming back. I definitely noticed something. There was a sparkle in their eyes, and it was like they were holding a candle in their heart, and the light was shining through their eyes, and it was so bright that it was almost impossible not to notice it. I knew they had it, I wanted it, and I decided that I will keep coming back until I find it. And I attended a meeting for almost 9 months, and nothing was happening, and I was getting very frustrated. During this time, I was also traveling into West Virginia area on my business travel. And during the weekends, I would drive around, and I found this beautiful place in a wilderness area called Dali Sods. Lots of mountains, valleys, water, streams, waterfalls. And there is a dirt road that runs on top of a mountain. And it turned out to be my favorite place. I'll go and sit there and soak up the Mother Nature. Peace and quiet. You can hear the winds blowing through the pine trees and birds chirping miles away. And I noticed the trees, pine trees, look very strange. They grew branches only on one side of the trunk. And I inquired among the local people, and they said that the northern winds blow so hard that the trees grow branches only on one side, so they don't uproot themselves. It was the second time I was there, and I was sitting there looking at those trees, and I came to realize that my life is like those trees, one-dimensional. This is the first time I saw myself just the way I was, a broken man, a hopeless man. I'm looking at myself, and I can hardly recognize the person I have become. And I sat there and I cried. I cried for the longest time. All the buried feeling that I had kept within me for so long were pouring out like a water from a broken dam. All the hard work and all the sacrifices, doing all that, my dreams have come to turn to dust. And it was a sad weekend. I cried most of the time. And I returned to Baton Rouge, and I was walking out of the airport. I made a promise to myself that from this day forward, I will be priority number one, and I will do whatever it takes to be happy, joyous, and free that I truly deserve. And I asked a very special person to be my sponsor and made a commitment to work through the steps. But yet I will come through another hurdle that will baffle me for quite some time. I was spiritually dead, and I was really struggling to understand what it is, how can I find it, and I was not really finding anything, and I was at a panic state. And one day after the meeting, I was talking to a friend about my dilemma, and she wrote down a name and a phone number and said, you know, he may help me. So I called Father Lefebvre at St. Patrick's Church and made an appointment to go see him. And Father Lefebvre listened to me for a while, my struggle about faith and spirituality. And after a while he said that, Jay, there is a log laying across the water that you want to cross. It is barely big enough to sustain your weight. If you just tiptoe, you will make it across. But if you just stop in the middle and start questioning whether you're going to make it through or not, you may not. He invited me to attend the church and also, you know, visit with him as often as I want. And he also told me about the RCIA program, and he said that it's already underway, but when they start again, they will let me know. So before I left, I went to the church to pray, and as I entered the church, I realized that I had been to this church before, about 6 years ago, for the baptizing ceremony of one of my good friends at work, his son's baptizing ceremony. And we had party-hardy the night before, and we were all five of us were sitting there, big hangover and a splitting headache. I could hardly keep my eyes open. But by the time I left the church, my headache was completely gone. And this has never happened to me. Somehow I felt warm and I felt like I'm in the right place, and I started attending the church. While I was still struggling with the spirituality, my sponsor finally convinced me that, hey, you know, I need to move on and start working on step 3, 4, and 5. So I made the commitment, and I say, you know, we'll start working on those steps. And the way I understand what step number three means, that only I need to believe, and if I could believe, then there's a good chance that I may be restored to sanity. And based on that, with a lot of love and support from my Al-Anon friends, I decided to take the journey of the fourth step. And it was a journey of self-discovery. I took the fearless and moral inventory of myself, and I realized that I had done a lot of right things for wrong reasons and many wrong things for right reasons. And some of my motives were not clear to me, and most of my motives were driven by anger, fear, resentment, jealousy, and all kinds of negative feelings and negative thoughts. I began to meditate to find the real reason behind my motives. And it was difficult to break through my denial and my self-righteous attitude to see the truth. But I continued to meditate, and I began to see the character defects hidden behind my selfish motives. Perfectionist, super caretaker, people pleaser, succeed at any cost, some of the character defects, just to name a few. And I realized that my actions had caused harm to many people around me, including myself. And I also came to understand that I was an equal contributor to my failures, and I stopped blaming other people for my problems, and I began to take the responsibility for my actions. I admitted my character defects to my sponsor, and I made most of my amends to people I had harmed by changing my attitude towards them. This journey taught me the true meaning of humility. And with that understanding, I was able to accept myself just the way I am, full of character assets and full of character defects. And it also helped, this change in attitude also helped me to forgive myself, that I'm just a human being capable to make mistakes. And I did the best that I could with what I knew and what I had. And the journey of the 12 steps helped me discover myself and helped me understand who I am and why I act and react the way I do. I also turned my character defects over to the care of God and prayed to have them removed. And since I understood my character defects, now I began to observe how they were affecting my attitude and my relationships. And I began to make positive changes in my attitude and my actions, and it began to make me feel good about myself. No wonder I was spiritually dead. My spirit was buried under all those negative feelings and negative thoughts. And my self-righteous attitude was blocking me from really understanding and finding the truth. But now all those things were gone, and I could reconnect back to my spirit. I can begin to feel my inner spirit, and I began to feel the true happiness coming from within me. And so I find that if I stay connected with my spirit, then I would be staying connected with my higher power. If I can see the connection between a dewdrop and an ocean, then I can feel the connection between my spirit and my higher power. And this was a wonderful gift, and I cherished the hard work that I did doing the fourth step, brought me to this understanding. And by this time, the church was starting the RCIA program, so they invited me. And I went to the first weekend retreat, and we were all given a copy of the Bible and asked to meditate. And I'm sitting under a tree, and I set the book in front of me, and I'm looking at it, and I know very little about this book, and I just didn't know where to begin. And I also began to question, you know, what am I doing here, and how am I going to relate to all these things. But then I picked up the book, and my eyes focused on the verse which said, "Ask and you shall receive, and knock and you shall open." God was always there in my life. It was I who was shut out from the inside. And today I understand that staying in contact with my spirit keeps me in contact with my higher power. The RCIA program was wonderful. I met a lot of parishioners. They were there for me during the Sunday Mass and also for each retreat. And there were many others that were praying for me who didn't even know me. And it was spiritually uplifting, and it also helped me build a strong relationship with God. So I did what I had promised to myself, that I will do whatever it takes to find the happiness, joy, and freedom. And finally I was there, and I had promised myself, and I did that. And but it is, to me today, it's a daily process. I have to constantly stay in contact with my spirit and my higher power. And because of that, I keep coming back, and I stay in contact with step number 10 and 11. And today I know that those things are very important to me. If I just let it go, then I could go back to where I was before. And that is very important to me, that I stay spiritually alive. So that's the reason I keep coming back to Al-Anon, and that's where I have found the true happiness, freedom, and joy that I'm really, really proud of, and all the help that I have received from you all, that has been very precious to me. While I'm working on my recovery, a lot of bad things are happening around me also. I'm going through divorce, community property settlement, and joint custody settlement, and we have engaged ourselves into raging battles, and my son has got caught up in this middle of it, and he's been left sort of ignored, and he's confused and he's frightened. He failed fifth grade and he was held back, and I sought help from the professionals, and they told me that if the situation does not change soon, then my son will begin to see some very serious behavior problems, and I had to let him go. In my ex-wife's opinion, I was a bad person, and I was a bad influence on my son, and she was going to go any extent to separate us. And I knew that if I continued this battle, it would be detrimental to all three of us. So I finally let it go, and for the next 2 years, our joint custody dwindled down to about two or three weekends a year, which did not include any holidays or his birthday. I also had a new boss at work, and his destructive behavior was obvious from the very first day. 5 years before he came, we had introduced two engineered plastic into the market, and which Ford, GM, and Chrysler loved it, and they were begging for more, and we had planned to deliver more of these products. But for the next 5 years, we will not put any new products out on the market, which will spell disaster later on. Our family dog, Buttons, was having all kinds of physical problems. And the veterinarian told me that all her symptoms are stress-related, and I told her what is going on. And she said that, you know, just try to comfort her as much as you can. But that would not happen because my business travel increased to almost every other week. And I had no choice but to leave her in the kennel. And eventually the stress of living in the kennel killed her. Despite all those things, I stayed focused on my recovery, because that's the promise that I had made to myself, that I will not stop and I will do whatever it takes to be happy, joyous, and free. And I also knew that unless I find recovery, I will not be of any help to anybody, or including myself. My business travel into West Virginia area continued, and I began to notice the natural beauty of Dolly Sides area during the summer, spring, fall, and winter. And I bought my first 35mm camera, and I started taking pictures, and I started showing it to my Al-Anon friends, and they said, hey, you know, you have an eye for photography. So that has turned into a lifetime hobby. And I also belong to Louisiana Photography Society, and we meet once a month, and we also compare our pictures. We have professional photographers come out and, you know, tell us about the photography and their skills and their talents. And we also go on field trips once or twice a month. And with a camera in my hand, I can immerse into something that really nurtures my spirit. It is very important to me, and I make sure that I have enough time in my busy schedule for this type of activities. While I was traveling in the Dallas Heights area before the fourth step, I also began to listen to country and western music. And some of those songs were just written for me. It helped me to get in touch with my buried feelings at the time, and I really needed that. So I said, why can't I listen to other music? And I started doing that, and today I enjoy listening to jazz, classical, Latin, South American music, Native American music, and I just love it. And Angie and I went to see a movie, and I heard French lyrics and the music, and I was very intrigued by it, so I'm in a search of French music now. But all this music written in different culture and different languages communicate a single common message, is peace and joy, and that's what I hear in the music. When I listen to the music, I'm still, and it nurtures my soul, it nurtures my spirit. And I make sure that I have enough time, in my busy schedule, to have some fun with listening to music. I also started practicing the 12th step and started participating into the Al-Anon service work. And my passion for service work was sparked at the regional service seminar in New Orleans in 1992. I went to one of the workshops and I heard that, we can take our literature to doctor's office and in turn they can give it to somebody who is in need. Wow, what a great idea. A little thing, little bit of my time can change somebody's life. And I have been active in service work ever since. And service work has helped me to get out of my shell and make new friends. Service work gives me a lot of spiritual growth. And serving as your delegate is really an experience of a lifetime that I will remember forever. And I just have no words to describe. Everyone probably knows how wonderful it is. It is hard work, but in Al-Anon service work, whatever you put in, you're going to get a whole lot more. And it's endless. And I will continue to participate in the service work because it nurtures my spirit. It is great to come and, speak with you all. Sometimes it's frightening, but, it is spiritually rewarding. But with the service work, I have grown, and I continue to grow. So those are the things that I continue to do, which nurtures my spirit. I also belong to a circle, Civitan Club, where we raise money and also work as volunteers for Special Olympics for handicapped children. And while I was working on my recovery, I was away from my club for almost a year, so one day I decided to go and visit my friends, so I went to the club meeting and they were discussing, they had started a singles club and it wasn't really doing too good, so they were looking at different alternatives to see, how they can help the club. And they decided that they will send one of the club members to help. And then they turned around and looked at me and they say, I am the only single person in the club, so I'll have to go. I said, I just came to say hello to you and, But despite my opposition, they drafted me for helping out the club. So I went to the club and I became their activity director. And I organized the activities, civic activities and social activities. We alternate every month. And for civic activities, we used to take children from Better Women's Shelter to Tunica Hills, or go to Voice of America home and do a birthday party, take a big pinata full of candies and cakes and stuff like that, do something like that. Or just go to the shelters and, buy the paints and leftover carpets from the contractors and go and fix up the shelters, paint them and put carpets in it and whatnot. And for the social activities, we go to some club member's house and have an evening party or a swimming pool party and have barbecue, or go to a Saints game, and those kind of things. And one of those club parties, club swimming pool parties, I met Angela on August 17th, 1986. And, you know, I was there, and there were lots of single women, and I was keeping my distance because I was really afraid that, you know, I will get hooked up with another alcoholic. And with her, it was different. We started hanging out together, and it just seemed like there was a chemistry, and we were getting along fine, and we just became buddies, and we started hanging out together, and we started dating. And she was everything that I had prayed for. She had, you know, she was just a beautiful person just to be around, and we were getting along fine, and we were, you know, just having a great time together. One day she invited me over to her house, her apartment, for dinner, and she was in the kitchen finishing up the dinner, and I was standing by the door, and she asked me to get something from the pantry, and I opened the door, and I saw two bottles of vodka in there. And it just frightened me. And I said, the lady that I have fallen in love may be an alcoholic. And I began to question, I began to pray, and I began to ask God, you know, why me? I just, you know, I should be spared. I you know, served my term. Why me, you know? And, but, you know, we kept dating. I never saw her drinking. We never argued. We had a great relationship. We were getting along great. And so I just continued looking for reasons to why am I here and why this is happening. And but at the same time, I knew that I'm dealing with the disease of alcoholism, which is powerful, baffling, and conniving, and there is no way I can win over this disease. So the thoughts of changing, getting out of the relationship came quite often. And during that time, I was getting ready to travel to Montreal, which is a long ways. So I say, you know, it will give me a lot of time in the airplane to meditate, and I will finally decide, you know, what I want to do. So before I left for Montreal, I invited her for dinner. And right after the dinner, she abruptly left. And I figured that maybe, you know, considering my state of mind, I probably wasn't a good host, and I probably said something that may have upset her. But anyway, so I went to Montreal, and straight from the airport, I went to the Cathedral of Notre Dame, and I prayed. And I told God that I cannot go on with this relationship. I cannot be the kind of husband that I want to be as long as I'm standing behind the alcohol as number two. And, you know, I cannot have a relationship as long as there is alcohol standing between us. And I came back, and I called her, and I told her that I have something very important that I want to discuss, and she said that she also has something important that she wants to discuss. So next day, I went over to her apartment, and before I said anything, she said she wants to go first. And she apologized for leaving early from the dinner. She said that she started feeling uncomfortable, and by the time she got to her apartment, she could hardly breathe. And she was taken to the emergency room, and she spent 3 days there. She had some sort of an allergic reaction, but they didn't find any reason for it. But she said the doctor told her that she better stop drinking, otherwise she may die. And then she said that she has turned herself into CDU. And then she said that if I wish to leave her, it would be okay with her and she would understand. And I was stunned, and I told her that I'm not going anywhere, and I will stay with her, and I will support her through the CDU. And fortunately, she decided to take care of herself, and she's sober since then, and we have a wonderful relationship, and we got married on July the 3rd, 1985. Only thing I had to remember is July the 3rd. But she keeps the count, and she lets me know every anniversary. Our tradition number one, which says our common welfare should come first, progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. It is the foundation of our relationship. We both try to stand on our own two feet mentally, physically, spiritually, and financially. And we both work our programs in our own way, in our own space, and without getting in each other's way. And we both are unique individuals. I like photography, music, and Al-Anon service work. And she likes gardening and cooking and reading. And we both have kind of grown into this individuality, and we have found something that nurtures our spirits. And we both support each other in those activities. And even though we are different in that aspect, but we still support each other because we want each one of us to be the best that we can be. And we pay special attention to make sure that, you know, we are supporting each other in any way we can. Over the years, we have also learned to find common things that we both like to do. And traveling was one of the first things that we learned that we both enjoy. And when I met her, I was traveling quite a bit, so that was kind of easy and gave us a lot of opportunity to travel together. And I was worried about her when we went to India. I thought, you know, she may not like the food and, you know, people sleeping on the sidewalks and all that stuff, but she was okay. She can handle all that. And so, you know, we really enjoy, we are good partners and travel together well, and we both enjoy doing those things. We both like to go to New Orleans Jazz Festival. We have been to the last nine in a row. And when I finish serving my term as a delegate, we'll probably go back to going to the jazz festival. We both like to cook. Once in a while, we get in the kitchen and we cook. And I also learned that, you know, her territory and my territory, so cooking is her territory. So when I go into the kitchen, I am in a supporting role. I do not make any decisions. So as long as I, you know, stay within the boundaries, she lets me in and she will let me chop her onions and bell peppers and stir the roux and all that stuff. She calls it a bonding experience. But we enjoy that. We also enjoy entertaining our friends. And after we got married, we built a 1,500 square feet deck in our backyard. And we have lots of friends, so we invite all of our friends for the deck parties. We do three deck parties during the summertime. I do two, and I cook smoked pork loin, and everybody brings a side dish, and we have a great time. And she does the third one, and she cooks redfish gomia, and we have a great time. So it's some activity that we both enjoy working together, and it really gives us a unity and comfort and something that we have grown into doing and working together on those things. So over the years we have worked those things, and we continue to look for those kind of activities that we can participate and work together. Communication is also a very important part of our relationship. We discuss things, and we communicate openly and honestly, and we try to reach consensus before we make any decisions. And we talk it out. If it's a small thing like, you know, which movie we want to go see or which restaurant we want to go see, a few minutes of communication. Or big decisions like vacations, planning for the vacations, planning for the budget, those are the things we start discussing about a year in advance. And so communications are very important. The conflicts has not gone away. They're there. But we have learned to manage the conflicts. And the understanding for the conflicts or how to resolve the conflicts, the guidance is in our concepts and our traditions. It's kind of hidden, but it's in there. But that's another one I will talk for some other day. We are not always standing on our own two feet mentally, physically, and spiritually, and financially. I struggled with my son's addiction during the 1999. The whole year was very difficult. And she was my third eye because I was overextending myself, bailing out my son from his problems. And she would point out to me, And at least alert me that, hey, you know, you need to look at this, whether you're really helping him or not. She's a cancer survivor, and while she was going through the cancer treatment, there were many days she was depressed. So I made her a special headband, and I told her that, you know, she can put on that headband and she can be depressed for that day, and I'll sit and listen all her sad stories and whatnot. And so, you know, we do these kind of things to each other, understand when somebody is not working on all eight cylinders, then we try to, you know, fit in. But we do it in a way that we do not lose our own balance. So the main thing in our relationship that we both constantly watch for is make sure that we are standing on our own feet and we are working on our personal recovery and we're taking care of ourselves the best way we know how. Like I mentioned, my son struggled with the disease of alcoholism during 1999. He had lost everything and he was living on the street. And the weekends he will come over, we will clean him up, feed him, get a good night's sleep for the weekend. And Sunday he will start pacing back and forth in our den. And that's the first time I have really noticed how powerful the disease is and how powerful the urge is. I was fearful for what he will do, but at the same time I was not angry with him, and I understood his dilemma. If my son had a choice, he would have asked God not to give him the disease. So who am I to question him, or who am I to judge him? I just simply had to let him do what he needed to do. I knew he was heading in the wrong direction, but I also knew that there is nothing I can do to stop him. So I would drive him into the most dangerous part of the town. And while I'm driving, I will tell him that that I love him, and he's my only child, and I don't ever want to lose him. He's not a bad person. He doesn't have a bad habit. He simply has a disease, and the disease is so powerful that if he does not watch, it could kill him. Whether he heard that or not, I don't know. He will get out of the car, and he will walk away, and I'll stand there and watch until he will disappear. And then I'll leave and leave him in God's hand and pray that he would be okay. This was very stressful to me, and at the same time, I knew that I wasn't really helping him. So I started telling him that, hey, you know, you are going in the wrong direction, and I will walk with you to a certain extent, but somewhere down the road, I will have to make a decision where I will make a 180-degree turn and I will have to walk away and you will have to continue down the wrong road on your own. You can call me, but I will only come if it is an emergency situation. And one day such call came and he had gotten into a fight and he was seriously injured and we took him to the emergency room. Fortunately, his injuries were not that serious. And we had a long conversation and appeared that he was willing to go through the treatment, so we took him to detox straight from the emergency room. And he went through treatment and 6 months of halfway house, and today he is 4 years sober. He comes visits us quite often, and he's just a joy to be around. And we even laugh about some of the things that he did during his drinking days. And I learned a lot from him also. I wanted him to be have good education, a good career, a good job, good life, good family. But today, none of those things are his high priorities. And finally, I had to accept him just the way he is and stop forcing my views and my expectations on him. And since I changed my attitude, he comes visits with us more often, and I do not ask him any of those things. Just simply try to support him to whatever he wants to do and how he wants to live his life. And while he was struggling with his disease, I also came in contact with our in-laws after 20 years. And it was different, and we had departed with a lot of anger, resentment, and bitterness. And it was all gone. They hugged me and they said they love me. And I even got a Christmas card from my ex-mother-in-law last Christmas. If I see him in a grocery store somewhere, they stop and they hug me and they said they love me. My ex-wife still drinks. She has isolated herself. And we all pray that someday she may find peace and joy that she truly deserves. And I am just very thankful to the Al-Anon program that it has helped me understand my alcoholic relatives. I didn't know anything about the alcoholism. Today I know exactly what it is, what is my role in it, and what I'm expected to do, and what I should do, and what are my boundaries, and I know all those today. And because of that, I have excellent relationship with all my alcoholics, whether they are drinking or not. And I'm truly grateful for the program and for the fellowship and my friends for showing me how to love my alcoholics. And for that, I will always be grateful to you. And I thank you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to come out and share my story today. Thank you.